If I could have your attention, we'd like to start the program. Hi, everybody. I'm Phil Rosen, and I'm your host. I'm one of the partners at Wagach Olamanji's and actively involved in the Middle East Forum. We are very honored today to have a spectacular guest speaker. But before I introduce Douglas Feith, what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about the Middle East Forum. Since it was founded by Daniel Pipes, who unfortunately couldn't be here today, in 1994, the Middle East Forum has become one of the most important and influential think tanks on Middle East affairs. There are four things that distinguish the forum, four strengths. Number one is positions. The Middle East Forum is right. They're right on the issues. They're often ahead of the curve. In identifying the issues. Two of them that stand out are, number one, they have a focus on fighting Islam rather than terrorism. They have a focus on convincing the Palestinians that the Jewish state is a permanent state and a permanent part of this world. And today, as we celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, the 60th anniversary of the State of Israel, there's no more important issue for Jewish people and probably for democracies around the world than the existence of Israel. Number two is groundbreaking projects. The Legal Project, Islamist Watch, Campus Watch, and Middle East Quarterly were all established because the forum identified a problem and figured out how to address it. Number three is reach. They've got a dramatic reach. The Middle East Forum's three websites attract over 400,000 visitors per month on a consistent basis, by far the highest number for any organization that provides Middle East focused information. I hope you'll find the Middle East Forum's efforts worthy of your support. Your tax deductible contributions are crucial in making the work of the forum have a profound and far-reaching impact. Together we can promote American interests in the world's most dangerous region while helping the United States defend itself at home. Thank you. I invite you to add your email address to the sign-up sheet outside to receive the Middle East Forum's materials as they appear. And I invite you to visit the Middle East Forum's website, www.meforum.org, which has articles and all sorts of membership information. Again, before we start, I ask everyone to please turn off mobile phones and pagers so that we don't interrupt our distinguished speaker. Also, please hold your questions till the end, at which time we're going to have a question and answer period. The Middle East Forum is pleased to present Douglas Feith to discuss his new book, War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. It chronicles his experience as Under Secretary of Defense for Policy in the Bush administration, 2001 to 2005, formulating policy at the highest levels of the U.S. government through critical stages of the wars in Iraq and against radical Islam. He's now a professor in national security policy at my alma mater, Georgetown University. He previously served in several capacities in the Reagan administration. His articles on foreign and defense affairs have appeared in the Middle East Quarterly, as well as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Commentary. He also went to Georgetown University and Harvard College. Just to give you an example of what the world out there, the right world out there, thinks of Douglas, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley called Mr. Feith, quote, an example of honesty, decency, and integrity, and that's what he is. I just want to make one additional non-prepared remark, which is that to show you what a person Douglas Feith is, all proceeds from the sale of his book are going to charity. Not one penny is going to him. Every penny is going to charity. So let me, at the end of his lecture and at the end of the question and answer period, Douglas Feith will stick around and sign copies of the book to those who want. Please join me in welcoming a true hero, Douglas Feith.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. It's It's a real pleasure to speak at a Middle East Forum event. I'm glad that Phil gave some explanation. I was going to say some of the things along those lines myself about the work that Daniel Pipes and the Middle East Forum do. It is an important source of analysis and information about the Middle East. I have a lot of regard for Daniel. I met Daniel in 1981 when I was working with his father on the National Security Council staff at the White House in the Reagan administration. And he said to me, I was doing Middle East policy, and he said, oh, my son does Middle East work, and arranged for us to get together. And he immediately impressed me, as I'm sure he's impressed a lot of you here who know him, as an enormously thoughtful and creative person. And anyway, I'm happy to pay tribute to his work, and it's good that you're all here to support the Middle East Forum. It's also nice to be in a gathering that I'm sure is excited about the fact that today is Yom HaAtzmaut, and it's a happy occasion, an occasion for celebration. And I hope actually to make it back to the Israeli embassy reception when I get back to Washington this afternoon, if the trains are on time. So Chag Sameach to everybody on that occasion. What I wanted to do in my opening remarks is spend a few minutes at the beginning on a view from a somewhat higher altitude than one gets when one is just focused on the day-to-day affairs as presented in the newspapers. Newspapers and daily commentary, especially now that we have this 24/7 news channels, I mean, they tend to focus us, you know, on the tops of our shoes, looking at just that day's or that hour's increment of news. And so what I would like to do is pull back a bit and try to remind everybody of some of the thoughts that were developed in the hours and days after the 9/11 attack. Because if you're going to understand, I mean, what I have done in my book is I'm looking at the development of the strategy for the war on terrorism. And if one is going to understand that, it's useful to go back and try to capture a little bit of the frame of mind that we had as a country, and specifically that the policymakers had within the administration in the immediate aftermath of that attack. When it occurred, President Bush described 9/11 as war. And I think for many people, the term war looked obvious, even inevitable in retrospect, but it was in fact a break with past U.S. policy. No previous president had used the term war to describe a terrorist attack. The standard U.S. response for decades, as I'm sure you all know, was to dispatch the FBI to try to find individual perpetrators of terrorist attacks and arrest them and prosecute them and punish them. But there was nothing obvious or inevitable about what the president said and how he viewed 9/11 as war. And there was nothing obvious about how the president and his national security team should craft a strategy to deal with the problem that manifested itself in that attack on New York and Washington. And there were serious challenges to crafting a strategy to fight a war against an amorphous enemy that was not only hard to locate, but hard to define. Now, I believe we actually, within the administration, developed a proper apprehension of the threat and a good strategy. Mark Twain made famous a quip about Richard Wagner's music. He said, "Wagner's music is better than it sounds." And along similar lines, my thesis is that President Bush's strategy against terrorism is better than it sounds. That is, the administration has done a better job of conceiving the strategy and even in executing it than it has in talking about it. And the administration, I think, has done an abysmal job of explaining what it is doing and why. And that's a serious problem, and I deal with that in the book as one of the several major criticisms of the administration. But I think it's important to at least distinguish between the kind of analysis that was going on inside the Situation Room and then the related but separate question of how did the administration articulate for the American people and the world what it was doing. Now, whenever a large challenge or a new major issue arose, my boss, Secretary Rumsfeld, would ask, what are the several major thoughts that should guide our deliberations on this issue? I mean, before we get into the question of how do we react, we've got to look at the question of how do we think about this? I mean, he used to, I mentioned the book, he used to have a remark that if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. So start off by asking, what are the large strategic thoughts? So what I'd like to do is quickly run down, there were, I believe, five major strategic thoughts that were developed immediately after 9/11. And they laid the foundation for our, pretty much our whole national security policy, certainly within the war on terrorism. And you will see the connections to Iraq, and then I'll talk more specifically about Iraq. First, and this was in some ways the largest thought, after the destruction of the towers here in New York and the attack on the Pentagon, it was clear the United States had to do something. And there was a question of what should we be trying to accomplish with whatever it is we're going to do in reaction to 9/11. Now, the immediate instinct of some officials, and this was certainly true at the State Department and the CIA, the immediate instinct was do what we've done in the past, find the people who did it and punish them. Now, there's some sense to that. I mean, obviously, that's an important thing to do. But what Rumsfeld, the vice president, and the president said was that's not enough. That's not the strategic thought that should be guiding us. What we need to do is recognize that our obligation to the American people is not simply retaliation and punishment. It's prevention of the next attack. Now, that was a gigantic thought. And basically, it put the whole country on a completely different course from what we would have followed had we been focused specifically and narrowly on find out who did 9/11 and punish them. And so that is the first major thought, is that the purpose of our action was not retaliation, but self-defense. The second is that the problem, or since the president called this a war, the enemy in the war is a network. And while the next attack could come from Al-Qaeda, the group that did 9/11, it could also come from other parts of the global jihadist network. And the enemy network includes not only the terrorist groups, but their state supporters. And that was another very large thought. And the different elements of the network, the different groups and states, maintain among themselves various types of interconnections, financial, logistical, operational, ideological, and one of the purposes of our strategy should be to sever those connections by which important support is provided to the terrorist groups. Now, the third main thought was that the chief danger that we were facing, as we saw it immediately after 9/11, was the danger of terrorist groups getting and using weapons of mass destruction. Now, what 9/11 showed was that we were not dealing with terrorists who were constrained by a desire to win broad international sympathy for their cause. Our enemies are not engaged in terrorism as political theater. See, for many years, the general view of terrorism, and there was a lot of good empirical basis for this view. The main view of the terrorism threat was that terrorist groups were interested in causing essentially small, spectacular attacks, limited casualties, to draw international attention to a political cause, in the hope that they could eventually convert that attention into sympathy. So you shoot up some ticket counters in Rome and Vienna, you blow up some Israeli school buses, and then you get invited to the United Nations General Assembly. And that was basically the view of what the strategy of the terrorists was. A scholar on terrorism made the observation that became quite well known, that terrorists want a lot of people watching, not a lot of people dead. And that was largely true. As I said, a lot of support for that in history. But 9/11 was a departure. The people who knocked down the World Trade Center and attacked the Pentagon wanted a lot of people dead. This was the first successful example of terrorism of mass destruction. Now, as long as one was focused on the terrorist phenomenon as I described it earlier, there wasn't great worry. There was some in the literature, but relatively little worry about terrorists getting WMD. Because WMD is not a great weapon if you ultimately want to convert the attention to sympathy. But if you're actually focused on mass destruction, as Al-Qaeda is, and as other elements of the jihadist network are, then there's a serious danger of terrorists getting their hands on weapons of mass destruction. And that's one of the things that focused us on that. Now, we, of course, immediately noticed, I told you that in our second main point, we talked about the network being a network of organizations and state supporters. Well, it's immediately obvious when you look at the list that the leading state supporters of terrorism are also the leading countries of WMD proliferation concern. And that coincidence was a fact of strategic importance. Now, fourth, a series of 9/11 type terrorist attacks on the United States could change the nature of our country. The purpose of our national security policy, as we saw it, is not simply to protect people or territory, but to secure our constitutional system, our civil liberties, the open nature of our society. It's in the openness of our society that both freedom and prosperity are rooted. So the stakes in the war, as we saw it, were not small or remote or dispensable. In fact, they couldn't be greater, which is why the president, in his first major speech after 9/11, the one I'm sure you all remember, September 20th of 2001, he spoke to the Congress, and he defined our war aim as defeating terrorism as a threat to our way of life. And that was actually a very carefully thought through definition of the aim. Which brings us to the fifth strategic thought, that we cannot rely on a defensive strategy. The United States has more rich targets than one can protect individually. If we tried to protect our country mainly by stopping terrorists here on our own soil, the government would be under extraordinary pressure, much greater than has been the case in recent years, to inspect, to intrude on privacy, to limit our movement, to rely on measures like ethnic profiling, or otherwise make highly undesirable, even if necessary, sacrifices of the civil liberties of Americans. The pressure to adopt police state tactics would increase as terrorist attacks occurred. And so even if it were possible to defend against terrorism with a defensive strategy of trying to defeat the terrorists on our own soil, it would be very possibly at the cost of our way of life as a free and open society. And that's what necessitated the U.S. strategy of initiative and offense, of hitting the terrorists abroad. The way I put it in the book is that President Bush decided that in dealing with the terrorists, we had either to change the way we live or change the way they live. Now, in my book, I discuss the development of the strategy for the war on terrorism, and I have a substantial discussion of Afghanistan, which, if anybody wants to get to it, we can talk about in the Q&A period. But what I'd like to do now is just comment a bit about the president's decision to go to war in Iraq. I've been doing a lot of interviews about my book in recent days, and I've heard from a number of journalists and others that the book is surprising because it tells a story that contradicts key elements of the conventional understanding of that comes from pretty much every major book that's been written about the Iraq War. For example, my book refutes the notion that President Bush came into office determined to go to war no matter what, and that the administration refused or failed to consider the arguments against the war. In fact, as I discuss at some length, the most serious analysis of the downsides and risks of going to war in Iraq was produced in the Pentagon by Secretary Rumsfeld and his team, not by Colin Powell, Rich Armitage, George Tenet, or others who are reputed to have been the voices of caution. In my book, I contradict the common allegation that Pentagon civilians didn't plan for post-Saddam Iraq. I explain what's wrong with the charge that the State Department had a plan that the Defense Department discarded. This was something that became so widespread that Senator Kerry used it in the presidential debates in 2004. I explain in the book what's wrong with the charge that Rumsfeld and his advisors were dupes of the Iraqi exile Ahmed Chalabi, and what's wrong with the assertion that we intended to anoint Chalabi the leader of Iraq. War and Decision, my book, quotes extensively from previously classified documents, from lots of memos among Rumsfeld, Rice, Powell, Tenet, the Vice President, the President, General Myers, and it recounts numerous meetings of the Principals Committee and the National Security Council. I mean, the Principals Committee is the same thing as the National Security Council, except when the President doesn't attend, it's called the Principals Committee. And in those meetings, those meetings were usually designated Principals plus one. And so I was generally Rumsfeld's plus one. And when I recount the meetings in the book, I do so not on the basis of after-the-fact interviews in which people remember or claim to remember what happened in meetings 3, 4, 5 years ago. It's remarkable how people generally remember themselves as brilliant and prescient. What I do is I recount the meetings on the basis of the notes that I took at those meetings. And I made the radical decision that I'm going to put words in quotation marks only if they were actually spoken by the characters at the very time and place described. I mean, I hope I start a trend. Among the main topics covered in the book is the rationale for the Iraq War. I explain what the president and his top officials were concerned about, why Iraq was a problem that was made more urgent and more worrisome by 9/11, even though we did not believe that Saddam was involved in the 9/11 attack. The book reviews the issue of politicization of intelligence and the accusations of manipulation of intelligence. It explains the actual controversy between my office and the CIA over the Iraq-Al-Qaeda relationship. That controversy was not a clash in which defense officials argued that there was an intimate Iraq-Al-Qaeda relationship and the CIA analysts were arguing for a more sober assessment. Rather, it was an argument about methodology and professionalism. It was a criticism by Defense Department officials that the CIA was politicizing its own intelligence. As it turns out, the way the story got explained to the press was by CIA people talking to the press. So, of course, that's not how it was described. But I was on a panel recently with James Risen of the New York Times, and he made the observation that which is, I think, absolutely important and correct, that the Pentagon lost the leak wars with the State Department and the CIA because the Pentagon didn't leak. And that's largely true. We also, not only didn't we leak, which is, I think, admirable, we didn't talk to the press very much, which was actually foolish. But it's quite important to understand that, going back to the point that I made before about how my book contradicts the conventional wisdom, that there is a multi-layered conventional wisdom out there, reflected in several dozen books about Iraq, almost all of which came from a handful of sources in the State Department and the CIA. And so, and it was something that was being talked about and promoted in real time. So the people who talked to the press as these debates were going on wrote not only the first draft of history, but like the first three or four drafts of history. And I recognized that in writing my book, I was going to be telling a story with a major credibility deficit, partly because I'm contradicting so much of what people think they know to be true, but also because we were specifically accused of being untruthful. And so the way I handled that is relying very extensively on documents. And you will notice if you see the book that there are 530 pages or so of text, and there are 140 pages of notes and reproduced documents. And so my basic view is, even if people think that I personally have no credibility at all, they have to deal with the fact that I'm quoting documents that are part of the public record. And in many cases, I've made them available on a website. So I mean, it's hard to argue that with the fact that there are documents that say this was the rationale for the war that Secretary Rumsfeld actually put forward to President Bush on such and such a date in this document. And then I quote the document and I cite the document. And if the document is now publicly available, there's a website where people can look it up. Now, perhaps most newsworthy, the book explains for the first time anywhere the key post-war plan developed by the administration for political transition in post-Saddam Iraq. It was a plan that was developed in the Defense Department, and it aimed to prevent a prolonged U.S. occupation of Iraq. It was a plan to put Iraqis in charge of their own government promptly after the overthrow of Saddam, and it built on our experience in Afghanistan, where we overthrew the Taliban but did not create a U.S. occupation government. And we did not have the kind of insurgency in Afghanistan that we wound up confronting in Iraq. Much of the, you know, this was a plan that the president actually approved. And much of the latter part of the book deals with the extremely complicated, difficult question of how this plan was undone and the harmful consequences that I think came from the undoing of that plan and the creation of an occupation government that lasted 14 months. At the beginning of that period, we had problems in Iraq. At the end of that 14-month period, we had a full-blown insurgency. And I think it was a very costly error. Now, while the book recounts controversies and debates, it does so in a way that I think is far more fascinating than the kind of snide and shallow self-justification that's typical in memoirs of former officials. I refer in the book to the "I was surrounded by idiots" school of memoir writing. And I don't like that school. I find it boring and bad history. While I was in the administration, I had many disagreements with other officials, but I generally thought that their arguments had important merits. When I disagreed with them, I usually did so because I thought that an alternative strategy or policy had even more merit. And in my book, when I present the positions of Rich Armitage or of CIA officials with whom I disagreed, I present them respectfully. I use language that I think they would agree fairly represents their views, and when I quote them, I try to do so in context. I don't call them nasty names or try to kill them with adjectives. I try to be critical about all the work that I discuss, that of other agencies and departments, that of the Pentagon and of my own office and myself. I tried to make the book civil and useful and accurate as one person's account can be. As I said, I care about accuracy, which is why I relied so heavily on the contemporaneous written record, and why I have such an extensive section of footnotes and endnotes. I would like readers to read the endnotes, and I'd be happy if they challenge me on my use or interpretation of the documents. And the name of the book is War and Decision. I created a website called warandecision.com, and if you go on that website, you can click on citations by chapter, and all the endnotes are reproduced. And any of the documents cited in the web, in the endnotes, that are unclassified or journal or newspaper pieces publicly available, you can access by just clicking on the links on the website. And I was very pleased the other day. I gave a talk at Georgetown University, and the professor who was Dan Byman, who was a Clinton administration national security official, gave the criticism of my talk. And when he addressed the website, he said it will strike fear in the hearts of professors across America. He said the idea that somebody makes it easy for someone to check one's footnotes, he said, is a terrifying thought. But he complimented it. I was very pleased. As you know, the essence of scholarship. I mean, I would like to invite all of you to read the book and visit warandecision.com and plunge into the actual record of the fateful decisions that the Bush administration made at the dawn of the war on terrorism. Thank you.
Just make a few comments and we'll go right to questions.
Sure. Great. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. As many of you know, my name is Joe Skelly, and I'll be moderating the discussion period. On behalf of the Middle East Forum, I'd like to thank Douglas Feith for his comments today, which, like his book and I'm sure his website, open a window onto one of the most important decisions of our time. Likewise, I would like to thank Phil Rosen of Lal Gotchall for his introduction and for kindly hosting this event. And now, I'm sure the audience has questions to ask. We will go around the room and get to as many as we can. We'll start with the gentleman in the back.
Well, I mean, in schematic form, what I would say, I mean, the solution in Iraq is two things. It's trying to contain the magnitude of the problems, and there's been some significant progress in that area. And you heard Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus outline what's happened over the last 9 months or so. There's been progress. You've seen, for example, the Sunni tribal leaders have basically decided that their strategy was wrong. I mean, they had a strategy of supporting attacks on the Shiites, creating chaos, allying with Al-Qaeda, and trying to drive the Americans out. And beginning a little over a year ago, after the Shiites started to fight back, the Sunnis, who are about 15 to 20% of the population, decided that the strategy of creating chaos is actually very dangerous for them. I mean, it didn't look so dangerous when the Shiites weren't fighting back. But when the Shiites started fighting back, the fact that they're 15 to 20% of the population, the Sunnis, began to tell. That realization corresponded with the fact that having been in bed with Al-Qaeda for a number of years, they decided, the Sunnis did, that they didn't like their bedmates. And now the Sunni tribal leaders are not supporting attacks on the Shiites, and they are allied with the United States against Al-Qaeda. So they did a 180-degree reversal of their strategy. That's an example of a development that has contained the magnitude of the problem in Iraq. And so the general strategy is, in that and many other ways, try to contain the magnitude of the problem, while at the same time increasing the capacity of the Iraqis to manage their own problems. So, and you have several major examples of steps in the right direction there. By the way, none of these steps, as General Petraeus has pointed out, are irreversible. So I don't mean to sound like Pollyanna. I'm just pointing out that there have been some positive steps. It's one hopes that things will continue in this direction, but that may not be the case. It certainly could be changed if the United States changes its policy. But the capacity of the Iraqi security forces, for example, has increased. In particular, the army. The army is progressing better than the or faster than the police are. But there's been a marked improvement in the operational capabilities of the Iraqi security forces. There have also been political steps forward in Iraq. Power sharing, revenue sharing, and the like, some legislative progress. So basically, the answer is, if you can contain the magnitude of the problem, I mean, another contribution to containing it is Sadr has declared a ceasefire. And he's maintained it even though Maliki was attacking him, which suggests it's possibly that Sadr feels weak. It's a little unclear. There are debates about exactly what's going on with Sadr. But in the meantime, he's not fighting, which is a great thing. And so if you can get to the point where you're containing the magnitude of the problem while you're increasing the capacity of the Iraqis to handle their own problem, at some point the crosses curve, and you get to a point where the Iraqis, who are going to continue to have major problems for many years, are going to be able to handle them largely on their own. Now, to my mind, that's a definition of success. And one of the problems I have with what the administration has done is the administration, I think, has confused the country and the world about the definition of success. I mean, at first it was quite clear the definition of success was removing the threats posed by the Saddam Hussein regime. And that was absolutely clear to those of us who were working, you know, why were we contemplating doing this at all? It was because of those threats. Removing those threats was a major contribution to U.S. national security policy. But what happened is, at beginning in about the fall of 2003, the president pretty much stopped talking about threats altogether. I have a chart in the book. I think it's page 476, if I recall correctly, that plots how the president's rhetoric changed. And he stopped talking about the threats. He started talking exclusively about democracy promotion. And there were a number of terrible consequences of this. The most serious was he, in effect, redefined success. He moved the goalposts away from us and started defining success as stable democracy in Iraq, which a lot of Americans, for perfectly good reasons, are very skeptical about. And they also wonder, why are we sacrificing like this to bring democracy to people who don't seem to be, you know, inclined that way or perhaps capable? And that was, I think, a gigantic error that almost cost us the war last summer. I mean, the Congress almost pulled the plug on the Iraq operation, partly because the administration had been so maladroit in handling this effective redefinition of why we went to war and what constitutes success. But I think the answer to your question is a proper definition of success is if Iraq continues to have serious problems, but can manage its own problems largely on its own with a little bit of outside support, and that outside support does not include U.S. combat. And if that's the case, I think there are, you know, that's an accomplishment for the United States. Now, you raise the question of Iran. I would say two things about Iran to start with. One is, we have a policy that has, with regard to Iraq, there are some people who say that they believe that Iran automatically benefits from what we've done in Iraq. There's more scope for Iranian interference in Iraqi politics. Some people have said that empowering Shiite Arabs necessarily redounds to the benefit of the Shiite Persians. My view on that is it depends. There are some outcomes in Iraq that could redound to the benefit of Iran, but there are some outcomes in Iraq that could seriously hurt the clerical regime in Iran. And if the Iraqis establish a reasonably stable government that are selected by the people, there are Iranians who might ask, how come our fellow Shiites in Iraq get to select their leaders and we don't? And so people who assert that Iran necessarily benefits from what's going on in Iraq, I think are assuming something that may or may not be true. And as I said, it kind of depends on how things come out in Iraq. On the broader question of our problems with Iran, we have been focused on trying to induce the Iranians to give up their nuclear program, and we have not been successful. And so, I mean, there's an extremely serious challenge that the United States has, either to say, never mind, and then live with the consequences of a nuclear Iran, or to come up with some way to make more effective our strategy in dealing with the Iranians. But I mean, at the moment, nobody can say that our policy in Iran is succeeding.
As we all know, Iraq is a very complicated place. Many people who've studied it for many years say they still don't understand it. When these decisions were being made, was there anybody nearby close who actually had a very fine-grained understanding of what Iraq was all about? I mean, my sense was that only this is outside of total speculation, that nobody in power knew anything about democracy in the third world countries. They did not know the difference between the various tribal politics and the role that Saddam had played in the tribal politics. In other words, it's not my opinion, but people who do know the area describe this as foreign policy but absolute amateurs.
I've heard that many times. It's a common line of argument. I mean, in a certain sense, you could say that's been true of every American government since George Washington. We generally don't have. We didn't have professors of Vietnamese language and culture, running U.S. national security policy, and you never have. Somebody who is a deep expert in a subject is always going to say that the people in the government don't know what they're talking about.
Richard Pipes was an expert on Soviet politics and
I mean, to be technical, he was an expert on Russian history in the pre-Soviet period. So, I mean, I am sure that there are people who were really specifically experts on the Soviet period who would say he didn't know what they know. I tell you, that is... Let me try to take what I think is a serious element of your question and kind of move it away from this kind of the stand. There's a standard political cheap shot that you can always make. But then there's a serious point that you're getting at, which is the question of how much did the U.S. government know about things that it needed to know about? And the answer is the U.S. government was uneven. There were people in the U.S. government who actually had pretty impressive understandings of things like democracy in the third world and had specifically worked on these subjects, had thought about them deeply, had even published on them, had worked on them in previous administrations. So I don't think that that's correct. There were people in the U.S. government who knew a fair amount about Iraq, and we were also, many of us were in close touch with people who knew a lot about Iraq, including many Iraqis. I mean, one of the ironies is that you had a major antagonism in parts of the U.S. government to dealing with the Iraqi expatriates who in fact knew an enormous amount about Iraq. And some of the major experts in particular, for example, in the State Department, who were area experts, were the most antagonistic to the Iraqi expatriates. It was a paradoxical situation that you had the experts blocking out even greater expertise. One very serious problem we had, because when you get into this question of who in the government knows what, it's not enough that there's somebody in the government somewhere who knows something. I mean, the way the government works, certain plans get made and there are certain there are certain people and certain institutions that you can rely on, and there are other people who may know more, but they're not institutionally set up so that you can rely on them. I'll give you an example. The CIA is the institution that provides the main analysis on the basis of which, for example, the combatant commands make their war plans. So, on an absolutely crucial issue, the Iraqi police, and what was going to happen to the Iraqi police after the removal of Saddam, the CIA came and briefed the deputies committee. Well, I generally represented the Pentagon in the deputies committee. That was the highest level interagency national security policy making committee short of the cabinet level. So they came and briefed us. They briefed the principals and the president also. And in those briefings, they said, the Iraqi police are generally viewed by the Iraqi people as a professional group, not a major instrument of repression by the regime. In other words, they were not viewed the way the Republican Guard was viewed in the army. That the police would remain in their jobs after the regime got removed. It would be necessary to remove their leadership, but if you remove their leadership, you would be able to use the police. By the way, similar things were said by the CIA about the Iraqi army remaining intact. This was turned out to be completely wrong. CENTCOM based its war plans on the CIA. In other words, the CENTCOM's asking the question, what kind of security forces can we count on after we remove Saddam? And the official answer from the people in the U.S. government responsible for answering questions like that was, you'll be able to use the Iraqi police and military. Now, when they briefed the deputies committee, I remember talking with Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, and others, and we specifically were saying, the police in a police state are not viewed as an instrument of repression? That just doesn't make any sense. And we challenged the CIA briefers. It turns out we knew better. Okay, there were other cases where we didn't know better. But I mean, on this, I'm not saying this to say that we were smart. I'm just giving you an example of the CIA got this wrong. We happen to have raised a properly skeptical question. But so what? The fact that we were skeptical could not affect CENTCOM's war plans because as an institutional matter, CENTCOM could not take two or three policy officials who were skeptical and say, we're gonna base our plans on what they say rather than on what the institution of the U.S. government that does the intelligence says. So when you raise questions about how much expertise, you may have a pocket of expertise here and there, but if the CIA, if the intelligence community is missing some major point, the fact that you have somebody else in the government who knows a lot about that is not going to help you because CENTCOM has to rely on the CIA for the key assumptions that it has for its operational plans. So these are very complicated questions about who knew what, and it was a serious problem. And this was something that came out in the Senate Intelligence Committee examination and the Silberman-Robb Commission examination of pre-war intelligence. The fact is the CIA knew a lot less about Iraq than it should have. And perhaps even more seriously, it knew a lot less about Iraq than it suggested to policymakers that it knew. I mean, one of the things that the Silberman-Robb Commission report criticized the CIA for was the CIA and the way it wrote its intelligence about Iraq, wrote it categorically when it should have written it tentatively. And it pretended that it had numerous sources when it in fact had few sources. And the example that they gave in the Silberman-Robb Commission report, which is quite interesting, is in the biological weapons area, the CIA said, we have multiple sources that say X, Y, and Z. And it turns out they had something like 35 reports from one person and one report each from two other people. And yet the way that got described as we have multiple reports, implying that they had a broad base for their information. those are problems that are going to have to be fixed in the relationship of intelligence to policy people if we're going to, you know, avoid major mistakes in the future. You know, it's an ongoing problem on how you deal with intelligence and policy.
What is behind, or what's the background to the president not repeatedly and aggressively making the case to the public and to the press? As somebody who's been part of what I guess what you might call the pro or hawkish blogosphere, we were complaining to each other that we were carrying President Bush's water for him.
Yeah, it's an issue that I talk about quite a bit in the book, because it's an issue that goes far beyond public relations and politics, and it really goes to the essence of strategy. In a democracy, if the government is going to do something that is large and maybe difficult and protracted, like a war, it is crucial that it build and maintain a base of popular support for what it's doing. And so this is much bigger than a PR matter, and it's even bigger than a political matter. It is actually a strategic matter. We could lose the war if the Congress decides that it doesn't like this, the way the president set the goal, you know, stable democracy. Congress could pull the plug on an effort that might actually be meritorious and worth sustaining. So it's an extremely serious problem. What I talk about in the book is that what seems to have happened is, while there was, I think, quite a clear rationale for launching the war, when we got to around September of 2003 and it was quite clear that we were not going to find the WMD stockpiles that the CIA had said we would find in Iraq, I infer that the president and his top communicators, and this was not done in National Security Council meetings, because I never heard this discussed in a meeting, but it's so clear from the record of the president's speeches that this occurred. I was not in the room when if there was ever a meeting where this was decided, I was not there, but you could so obviously see the results. Beginning in about September of 2003, the president almost completely stopped talking about the rationale for the war that he had used in the preceding 12 months, which is the threats from and the history of hostility and aggression of the Saddam Hussein regime. And as I said, you can see there's a chart that shows this in the book. What he did is he talked exclusively about the political future of Iraq and democracy promotion. Now, in doing that, one of the things that I think that the people in the White House tried to do, I mean, I noticed this because I would sometimes criticize the speeches, and I talk about that in the book also, where I sent memos to the White House saying, you know, the president should remind the public why we went to war, not simply talk about where we are now and what the future is. And the answer basically came back, we don't want to talk about the past. Now, the fascinating thing is, in wanting to shift the debate to the future, the White House made it absolutely clear that it wouldn't talk about the past. So guess what happened? The critics of the war talked exclusively about the past. And there was one hearing after another on Capitol Hill on post-war planning and pre-war intelligence, and the entire focus of the opponents of the war was retrospective. Why? Because they knew that if they talked about the past, they were not going to get contradicted by the White House. So the White House basically adopted a communication strategy that proves what happens if you pick a bad strategy. I mean, you could pick a bad strategy and then perfectly logically proceed to a disastrous conclusion. And that's what they did. And so basically, they forfeited the entire historical debate to the point where the critics of the war completely rewrote the history, which is how you got the situation where the administration made errors about WMD in Iraq, for example, relying on the CIA intelligence. And at first, the critics of the war said the whole war rationale was based on errors. Wasn't true. Part of the war rationale was based on errors, part of it wasn't. But the administration didn't correct that and say, no, so, you know, we did make errors, but we also said some things that were correct. They simply didn't talk about it. So the critics of the war hammered the war was based on error. And then they looked around. There was no pushback at all. So they took it an extra step. They said, no, it wasn't an error, it was a lie. And they looked around, and nobody contradicted them. And now it is widely believed in America that this war was based on, you know, the slogan, Bush lied, people died. I mean, in many ways, this was a self-inflicted wound by the administration. It just basically told the critics, anything you want to say about the pre-war period is open field running, and we will not engage you on historical stuff. Well, I think this was a disaster, and we're living with the consequences. And I think, that's not a complete answer to your question, but I think it is at least a part of the answer. I think the administration just thought about the strategy wrong. It came up with a few big ideas, everything flowed from those big ideas, and they were the wrong big ideas on how to communicate about this.
Do you have any sense of why they did that?
No. As I said, I wasn't in the room. I just saw the effects of it.
We have time for one more question, but I'm sure Mr. Feith will be happy to answer your questions as he signs the books. All the way in the back, right, blue shirt, thank you.
Why Iraq and not Iran in the first instance, particularly since the history of Iran in terms of being actively a terrorist attack, including against American sites, goes all the way back to Lebanon, and even before that, from the day the Khomeini regime came into power. The Israelis refused counseling going after Iran and not Iraq without reason. What was the basis for the choice of Iraq over Iran?
Well, my understanding is that the main reason, and this was as we saw it in the Pentagon, and I believe this was the president's thinking too, the main reason was war is a last resort. And you can't go to war unless you can honestly say to yourself and to the public that you have tried every reasonable measure short of war to solve the problem. Iran was an extremely serious problem. North Korea was an extremely serious problem. But the president could not say in 2002, 2003, that we had tried every reasonable means short of war to deal with the problem. He said, we have not done the diplomacy. We have not gone through the history that we have gone through with Iraq. In Iraq, the UN, starting in 91, made a major experiment in trying to put a containment strategy in place. And we tried, in Iraq, diplomatic denunciations, we tried weapons inspections, economic sanctions, no fly zones, no drive zones, limited military strikes, and on for a dozen years. And the president came to the conclusion in late 2002 that we had exhausted all reasonable means short of war to deal with this extremely serious threat. He could not come to that conclusion with respect to Iran or North Korea until he at least tried some additional diplomacy, IAEA stuff, UN stuff, and the like. Now, the question that raises now, all these years, 6 years later, is, at what point do you say there are still reasonable efforts that have not been tried? And it looks like this administration is just going to punt that, for the next administration to handle. But basically, in 2002, we were not in the same situation with regard to Iran or North Korea that we were with Iraq, with 16 Security Council resolutions and a record of having tried numerous means with a lot of patience, short of war, to deal with the Saddam Hussein threat.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please allow me to conclude with one last comment. Doug Feith has said that when historians look back, I want to be in the class of people who did the right thing, the sensible thing, and not necessarily the fashionable thing. Well, I think that many of us here today will agree that he did the right thing. And for that, we're grateful. Thank you very much. Thank you.